Senator John McCain, he isn't prone to intimidation. The 80-year-old Arizona Republican who is battling brain cancer began his remarks at the National Constitution Center in Philadelphia Monday night by recounting the days that he shared in the Senate with former Vice President Joe Biden. Biden introduced McCain to the crowd and praised his service on this night when he received the Liberty Medal. McCain's speech is where we begin with Laura Brown. She's an associate professor and director of the Graduate School of Political Management at George Washington University. She's the author of Jockeying for the American Presidency, The Political Opportunism of Aspirants. She also served in the Department of Education during President Bill Clinton's administration. Her areas of expertise include presidential politics and elections, campaigns, and political scandals. Laura, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me on this morning.
Well, let's begin with this latest flare-up, if you will, in the ongoing headbutting between President Trump and Republican Senator John McCain of Arizona. McCain, he was, as I mentioned, in Philadelphia Monday, where he was presented with this Liberty Medal. In his remarks, he delivered a harsh criticism of the White House's America First doctrine. Let's take a listen.
To refuse the obligations of international leadership and our duty to remain the last best hope of Earth for the sake of some half-baked, spurious nationalism cooked up by people who would rather find scapegoats than solve problems is as unpatriotic as an attachment to any other tired dogma of the past that Americans consigned to the ash heap of history.
And we did edit there for because there was a lengthy applause. But what is your reaction to those tough words by McCain?
Well, I think that McCain is trying to remind not only Americans, but all of his colleagues in Washington how important it is for our politicians to serve as really beacons and leaders in the world, that the world order doesn't just happen without sort of our pushing and prodding and making sure that, democracy sustains and that peace prevails.
And then President Trump addressed McCain's comments yesterday during an interview with a Washington, D.C. radio station, and he said at some point that he would fight back and that it wouldn't be pretty. How about that statement in reaction to what McCain said?
Well, I think this is about continuing President Trump's kind of personal issues with Senator McCain. If you recall back during the debates in the primary, time frame, we had President Trump, then candidate Trump, actually saying that he preferred individuals who weren't captured when he was referring to John McCain necessarily and possibly not being a military hero, as many look back at Senator McCain's history and believe he was. And so I think what we have is this dispute that then became very real during the health care repeal and that debate. And you saw Senator McCain essentially do a very dramatic gesture on the Senate floor where he essentially turned his thumb down to indicate his no vote against a repeal. So we now are in this moment where the Senate needs to pass a bill tomorrow that's related to reconciliation of the budget that would allow tax reform to move forward on only a partisan majority vote and not have to require cloture and a 60 votes going forward. And I think what you see is President Trump trying to hold his fire with McCain because they very much need his vote tomorrow.
And speaking of tax reform, that topic came up at President Trump's and Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell's news conference. Both of them were very optimistic that Congress would deliver. So let's hear a clip here of McConnell.
The goal is to get it done this calendar year. But it is important to remember that Obama signed Obamacare in March of year two. Obama signed Dodd-Frank in July of year two. We're going to get this job done, and the goal is to get it done by the end of the year.
Do you see Congress taking care of tax reform over the next 2.5 months?
I don't imagine that the final tax reform will wrap up or be complete by the end of this calendar year. I do think that what they know is they need to start moving the process forward. And what they're trying to do in some of these statements, in talking about the idea that it might bleed into the spring and that Obamacare wasn't, in fact, signed until March of 2010, what they're trying to do is essentially set up the expectations that if it does go into next spring, it is not a failure. It is, in fact, just part of the process, which is why so much energy is being focused on the vote that will begin tomorrow in the Senate to set up kind of the procedural path for tax reform to happen. And they're trying to essentially make it seem as though the vote tomorrow is a win on tax reform, not a win on the procedure to move forward with tax reform.
We're talking right now with Laura Brown. She's an associate professor and director of the Graduate School of Political Management at George Washington University. She's author of Jockeying for the American Presidency. Getting your reactions as well at 800-642-1234. How do you feel about the Republicans' tax reform plan? What do you think of the job President Trump has done in his first 9 months in office? Do you see a path forward for tax reform? 800-642-1234. Post your thoughts on tax reform winners and losers over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Laura, going back to tax reform, House Speaker Paul Ryan was in Madison on Monday, and he told a room full of business leaders that he's, quote, bullish that Congress will pass tax reform this year. He said there's far more agreement among Republicans on that issue than on health care. Ryan also said he expects some Democrats to vote for tax reform, particularly those from Wisconsin, North Dakota, and Indiana, who happen to be up for re-election next year. How likely is it that Democrats will get on board for this plan?
Well, again, this really comes down to the substance. It's going to depend upon what's in the bill. I mean, if you recall, there was a lot of bullish talk about repealing Obamacare as well. There has been a continued belief in kind of the high-level principles. In other words, Republicans mostly agree that Obamacare should be repealed, and yet they can't seem to make that happen in reality because the devil is in the details. We have a similar situation with the tax reform effort. Many Republicans want to see the, you know, overall corporate tax rate lowered. They would like to change some of the tax structure, and they are passing or looking to pass this budget resolution that would give them essentially $1.5 trillion in tax cuts over 10 years, in the sense of that would be the goal. The problem is, how do you get to the goal? And one of the real issues that Republicans have is that some have spent a lot of time arguing that the deficit is a problem and that our overall national debt is a problem. And that when you start to eliminate the one big revenue generator, which is essentially the repeal of state and local taxes being able to be deducted from your federal income tax, then none of these plans really actually are revenue neutral. So this is where it becomes problematic in terms of the deficit and the debt, and this is where Republicans are going to have to decide fiscal responsibility or tax cuts.
Well, Republicans now have support for tax reform from two key senators. Senator Thad Cochran from Mississippi is back in the chamber after having some health issues. And Senator John McCain announced yesterday he backs the budget resolution that can help tax cuts pass. So how does that lineup, if you will, impact the tax cut momentum?
Well, again, what we have to understand is that this budget resolution, which is what they're looking to pass and what Cochran's vote and McCain's vote is very important on, is about a procedure. It's going to allow them to move a tax reform bill through Congress with just a majority in the Senate rather than 60 votes. Now, of course, all tax reform efforts have to start and be passed in the House. So the substance of the bill is over in the Ways and Means Committee in the House of Representatives, because that's where it must start according to our Constitution.
Meeting with Cabinet on Monday, President Trump vowed to sign the largest tax cut in the history of our country, but Congress appears unable or unwilling to move ahead on a number of policy decisions. We're getting your thoughts, 800-642-1234. Tax reform has long been the big goal of policy leaders like House Speaker Paul Ryan. In one recent poll commissioned by a nonprofit outside group aligned with the GOP, nearly half of Republicans say it's their top priority, and three quarters call it a major one. So will the Republican tax cut plan make it to the president's desk? Lara Brown is helping us look at the issue. She's an associate professor and director of the Graduate School of Political Management at George Washington University, author of Jockeying for the American Presidency, The Political Opportunism of Aspirants. She also served in the Department of Education during President Clinton's administration. Join in the conversation, 800-642-1234. What do you think of a major piece of tax legislation? Who are the winners and losers? 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Let's go right to David in Toma. Hi, David.
Yeah, hi there. Anyways, this is about their tax reform. I believe that there will be, I'm pretty sure that anyways, some of these Congress, our senators, are kind of mad at Mr. Trump, and I'm pretty sure that they are going to vote no against this. And I can say right now the reason why I would say that, because Trump has made it clear to all the senators and anyone else like that, you know, their jobs are on the line because of Bannon, and he's going to, you know, he's threatening the primary, every one of them, and he's going to go over there to help them with the primary. And I will say right here now, any Republican or Democrat that votes for this bill will be primaried in the next year or two.
So, Lara, is there so much politics here at work and the future makeup of the Republican and Democratic Party?
Well, there's no doubt about that. I mean, when we talk about what the Senate is going to look like, we have to realize that there is a special Senate election going on in Alabama, and a poll that came out yesterday showed that the Republican and the Democrat were deadlocked in that race. So that will happen in another 8 weeks, and we will see, you know, if that could potentially change the makeup of the Senate chamber. There is also the reality that Senator Menendez from New Jersey is on trial for fraud, and whether or not he is convicted, there is also the possibility that that could change the makeup of the Senate chamber, depending on the timing. Then, of course, we have the health issues of both Senator Thad Cochran and Senator John McCain. So there are all four of those senators are sort of in different precarious positions, and that is before we even get to really the primaries or the midterms. In addition, there are only about 30 legislative days left on the calendar itself between now and the end of the year. And if you recall, the president had cut a deal with Senator Chuck Schumer and Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi in the House to essentially extend the budget and the debt ceiling through the end of the year. So there is also issues around funding the government that need to be done before December 31st, in addition to tax reform and possibly immigration reform. It's a huge call order for Congress to do in a very limited amount of time.
Let's go to Christopher now in Janesville with a question. Hi, Christopher.
Hi. I was kind of wondering about this new Republican tax plan and basically whether it balances the budget. I mean, during the Obama years, that's all we heard about was how Republicans are fiscal conservatives, and it was their, you know, reasoning for not doing a lot. And I just don't think we're going to hear much about that anymore. I can't imagine this tax plan is actually raising the tax revenue that's coming in, so they must be, you know, balancing the budgets in other ways. Or are we just not going to talk about balanced budgets anymore, I wonder?
So that's actually a really fascinating question, because that is part of the Balancing Act and really the debate that is happening in Washington as we speak. And this is really happening on the Republican side of the aisle, because the Republicans are in control of Congress. And there is this question about, yes, they all want tax cuts, but if you cut taxes and you don't have, if you will, offsetting taxes to raise revenues, you're going to throw the budget and essentially the deficit even further out of balance than it is at this moment. And so what we are seeing is Republicans trying to come up with creative solutions to raise revenue that allow them to still do the reform of the different tax brackets and the lowering of the corporate tax rates. So the main proposal on the table is to repeal from the tax code the ability of individuals to deduct their state and local taxes from their federal income tax. Now, you might imagine that in high tax states, places like New York, California, New Jersey, Illinois, Republicans who are in those states, because there are many Republicans in those states, really don't like those plans because it hurts their constituents the most. And this is where there is tremendous tension about how much could they add to the deficit, how much do they believe that supply-side economics actually will grow the economy, and really, how much do they need to get in terms of tax cuts to say that they've created a massive reform and a win?
Well, Christopher, thanks for calling in. Lara, we got a framework of this tax reform plan in the end of September, but there's still a whole lot of details that need to be filled in. Do we know enough about it in order to truly understand who are the winners and losers under the plan?
No, not at this moment. What we really have is exactly what you said, a framework. It's an outline that describes some of the priorities and some of what might be characterized as a wish list for Republicans, both in the administration and in the House, as to what they would like to see in the bill. But there are many, many details that have to get worked out, and those are only going to get worked out once we get through the procedural hurdle later this week with the Senate passing the reconciliation bills.
Let's go to Todd in Janesville with a question. Hi, Todd.
Hi, good morning. I got an email on this from my Congressman Ryan, and there are supposed details with all kinds of links in the email, and I clicked and clicked, and I could not find the details of this reform, particularly what the exact brackets are as far as the income levels. Does anybody know yet?
So on that level, they have put out some proposals, if I recall correctly, and I'd have to look it up. They're talking about reducing the number of brackets. I think it's from 7 down to 3. But this is what is not known yet is sort of where these brackets would start and stop, who would be essentially in the different brackets. They're talking about essentially the top marginal rate coming down from, I believe it's 39% down to 35%. But again, I'd have to go look them up specifically. But the Tax Foundation, I believe, does have all of this information if you want to pull that up.
Todd, thanks so much for calling in. We're talking with Laura Brown, who's helping us look at issues on Capitol Hill this hour. She's an associate professor and director of the Graduate School of Political Management at George Washington University. Join in at 800-642-1234. How do you feel about the Republicans' tax reform plan? We're talking about that. How do you feel about President Trump, who has been on the job here in his first 9 months in office? How do you feel about the America First vision and how it is being laid out? 800-642-1234. You can post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Laura, I want to circle back to Monday, President Trump with Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell. The two of them appeared together at a news conference at the White House, somewhat out of the blue, and expressed their desire to install conservative judges at the appeals and district court level. First of all, give us a sense of how important that issue is, particularly for Republicans.
Well, I mean, I think what we're really talking about here is that there are so many politics that are happening at the partisan level, right? So, obviously, one of the things that has long been true is that the president essentially appoints judges, the Senate confirms federal judges, and for the last two decades, this has become a very partisan issue in terms of appointments. And I know that the Democrats have worked very hard in this administration to stop many of President Trump's appointments from going forward. And this is where I know that the Senate and McConnell is trying to change up the rules so that these judges move forward. But I guess I'm not sure what more you want to kind of understand about these judgeships.
And remind us, too, what is the blue slips and the process to getting these judges installed?
Well, what that really has to do with is that it has always been a tradition that the sitting senators from the home state of where the judges would be appointed essentially got approval or a sign-off on who would go to the bench. In other words, it was long a sort of deference of the president, where the president would say, I'm not from your home state. I'm sure those home state senators are going to know who this proposed nominated judge is. I'm not going to move this name forward unless the senators say, yes, this person deserves to sit on the bench. And what has now happened is because we have a much more polarized country in terms of our partisanship, and we now have states, you know, like California that are represented by two senators who are both Democrats, and we have a president who's a Republican, the sort of thinking is, why should we go to the senators when those senators may be from the opposite party and they're not going to agree with us anyway? They're not going to like any of the judges we put forward.
And given the infighting that is going on, is there any, you would think Democrats would be trying to slow down the process to the path to these judgeships. Is there time on the calendar to do these types of vetting for these judgeships?
Well, this is the interesting part about the U.S. Senate. Most political scientists think of the United States Senate as an incredibly unruly body, in that every senator has a tremendous amount of power, and they really can, if they choose, throw a monkey wrench into the process and make things take longer. So this is where we get to notions of filibuster and the idea that they can even sort of put forward a threat to filibuster, and that then you would need to have 60 votes to overcome that issue. Well, as we have seen partisanship and polarization evolve over the last couple decades, we have also seen more procedural maneuvers to do things on a strict majority. And this is where we are with this tax reform effort, which is why they are trying to move it into the budget, because a reconciliation bill only needs a strict majority. It is why they tried to do the Obamacare repeal through a budget resolution and through this reconciliation process, because, again, it only needs a strict majority. It is why we saw, the Senate essentially go nuclear last year, where they changed the procedures for some of these nominees.
Let's go to Donna in Milwaukee. Hi, Donna. Go ahead.
Hi. I was wondering, isn't this kind of like what they did with Obama, not wanting to pass anything because of what he was or where he is? Nobody wanted to work with him, or they didn't even want to work together. They were all working against each other, and they're still doing it.
Laura.
Well, yes, it's true in the sense that the Democrats are in, I would consider themselves, a minority crouch, where they are kind of in a defensive position trying to gum up the works. But what is different about right now versus the time with Obama is that Obama was working with an opposition party Congress. So, you know, if you recall, in 2010, the Republicans won the House, and then in 2014, they won the majority in the Senate. So Obama was working across the parties. And what we have in this situation is Donald Trump, who is a Republican, trying to work with his own party. And that is, in fact, where what we see is different than what we've seen in the last few presidencies.
So how important would you say it is for Republicans then to pass tax reform if they want to stay in their jobs, hang on to their House and Senate seats?
Well, I believe that they all feel it is deeply important, and the one thing that is keeping them attached to both President Trump and essentially their majority control. The problem is that what is good for the collective, all Republicans all together, is not necessarily good for any one individual Republican with respect to their constituents or their past promises. So this is where politics really is the key to it, is not understanding essentially what is in your self-interest. It's in understanding what is in everybody else's self-interest.
Donna, thank you so much for calling in. President Trump's approval rating is holding steady, largely unchanged from late last month, holding at 37% in the latest CNN poll. But the number of respondents who believe things in the country are going well has dipped, as has the president's approval rating when it comes to hurricanes. We're doing a national politics check-in this hour with Laura Brown, looking at the approval rating as well. She's an associate professor and director of the Graduate School of Political Management at George Washington University, author of Jockeying for the American Presidency. Join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of the job President Trump has done in his first 9 months in office? Do you see the America First vision working for you? Let's discuss. 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Back after this news update. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're doing a politics check-in this hour with Laura Brown. She's an associate professor and director of the Graduate School of Political Management at George Washington University. She's author of Jockeying for the American Presidency, The Political Opportunism of Aspirants. You can join into the discussion, 800-642-1234. What do you think of the latest CNN poll that shows the president's approval rating holding steady at 37%? What do you see as the major win thus far for the GOP in the Trump White House? Let's discuss, 800-642-1234. You can post your thoughts over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Lara, the polling can help people gauge widespread American opinions. This new poll out from CNN shows Trump's approval rating sitting at 37% with a 57% disapproval. That's about where they were in late September, though fewer people now see things going well for the country. What does this CNN poll look like to you?
Well, I think the interesting thing about where we are in terms of polling is you see how much the country is essentially locked in with their, if you will, their team's beliefs about whoever they are judging in politics really has to do with what party that person considers themselves a part of and what party the politician is that they are judging. So, for instance, the vast majority of our presidents who have been polled, you know, when there's polling that's been around, have had sort of around the 50% or higher mark at this point in their presidency. But it is true that when you look back, Gerald Ford, at this point in his presidency, had a similar approval rating. The biggest difference, though, between the time of Gerald Ford and the time now with Donald Trump is that there were more than just Republicans who made up that 38% in Gerald Ford's overall rating.
Okay.
Nowadays, it's just Republicans.
And we also had some news out about the percent of Americans who say that the news is something they can trust and true.
Right. And this, again, is where you see this kind of locked in, I vote with my team in how I express my opinion in polls, rather than I judge the facts or the circumstances based upon their merits. This new poll that is out this morning from Politico and the Morning Consult says that 46% of Americans believe that the news media are fabricating stories when it comes to President Trump. Extraordinarily, only 37% of Americans believe that the media are not making up stories. So what we're really talking about here, and this is where I would say it's tremendously frightening, is that all of the kind of talk about fake news and it's not true that we have heard from the White House and we heard from President Trump when he was a candidate has essentially convinced and influenced Republicans who are now making up that 46% of the American public. In fact, three-quarters of Republicans say that they believe the news media are inventing stories about Trump.
White House Press Secretary Sarah Huckabee Sanders was interviewed yesterday on the Hugh Hewitt radio show. She said Trump is performing much better than the polls indicate and is sitting pretty well for 2020. Here's Sanders.
He's had an incredibly successful first 9 months in office, and I think the next two and a half, three years are going to be equally as successful, including getting tax reform done, which is going to be a big deal and make a really big impact on most Americans, and they're going to be begging for four more years.
Yes.
So begging for four more years, should we be putting so much weight in polling?
Well, yes. Look, polling is important. In fact, the polls, much to sort of everyone's concern, actually did suggest what would happen in the election last year. The reality is Hillary Clinton did obtain more votes, got a larger percentage of the public's overall support than did Donald Trump. But because we don't vote in a national way, we vote via the Electoral College, Trump's vote in the Electoral College made him the winner of the presidency. So polls are showing what is real. The problem is that what we don't understand and what we're not, I think, accurately assessing is that really what we have is a public that is resistant to hearing new information. So Democrats always want to believe Democrats are doing the right and good things. Republicans always want to believe Republicans are doing the right and good things. Independents are somewhere in the middle. But we know that when it comes to voting, most people vote their party. Therefore, there is a rigidity in the polls, and there's very little sort of, if you will, opening for any level of persuasion or for the facts to determine the circumstances.
Let's go to Brad in Madison with something along that line. Brad, go ahead.
Yeah, good morning. Just following up on what you're saying, I don't think that we've caught up to the ability to cognitively process so much information, you know, that exists in today's world. And so when people on the inside are gaming the information that's put out, people that don't have time to really dig for sources, understand where it's coming from, are really susceptible to believing, you know, just inaccurate stuff. One last quick comment. I understand people's difficulty with leadership and politics and all these kinds of things. However, if you just total what's happening, you know, currently we're going to deport hundreds of thousands of kids. We're going to kick people off healthcare rolls. We're going to build walls to keep people out. We're going to make coal great again. We're going to remove ourselves from scientific inquiry with regards to climate. We're going to, you know, on the verge of a possible war. I mean, it's incredible when you think about where we're really headed in all these domains.
And as Brad mentioned there, not enough time to do your homework on this laundry list of items.
I think that's 100% accurate. I really believe that part of where we are is there's just so much confusion. It is true that there is sort of information overload. Our world is changing fast every single day. And I do think that most people, I mean, forget most Americans, it's just most people in the world are having a hard time kind of absorbing all of the changes that are happening. I will tell you I'm working on a book that compares the Gilded Age with what I call the Global Age. And if you look at both of these periods, that time in the late 1800s, we were moving from an agricultural society into an industrial revolution. Our politics were similarly confusing, and they were upsetting and roiling, and there was a lot of turmoil. And I think when you look at our time, you can see those same kinds of issues causing fundamental problems sort of in our politics and in our society. And this is really about the fact that the economy is changing so fast, human beings can't adapt to this change that quickly.
Brad, thanks for that call. Travis, go ahead, in Lake in the Hills, Illinois.
Hey, good morning. I would just like to, I was curious, I just heard about the poll right now, and I apologize, I didn't read about it or anything like that. But the question seemed to be something, is there elements of the media that are fabricating stories about Donald Trump? And it seems like if you were to answer that question, you're not going to be wrong or right. There are elements of the media that are genuinely doing that. There are elements of the media that are reporting properly. It seems like it would be more that it has to be, or it ought to be a little more closer to a distinguish of who's reporting properly or who is actually, I don't know, and I don't want to be the finger pointer, too, because, I mean, we have this kind of freedom, too. Benjamin Franklin was doing it, too. He was just screwing around with jokes and stuff. So,
well, let's get Laura here to weigh in. Laura, go ahead.
Oh, I think that's a really great point, that what could be going on here is sort of some bad questions, because it may make it so that people are not distinguishing the different types of media. Are we talking about sort of broadcast news and the New York Times and the Washington Post, or are we, in fact, talking about the kind of left-leaning or right-leaning websites that are consistently kind of spinning the news or focusing on things that are not necessarily true. So I think that's a wonderful point, because it is true that when you ask a question in polling, a lot of the answer can be about what sort of latent understandings does the respondent have. And it is true that there could be some confusion in this. They did in the poll, and it's on the Politico website if you want to read about it, they did ask, according to what they said, they asked about the news media fabricating stories. So they did put news before media, but I think there is the possibility of some confusion.
Lara, as we begin to wrap up, by the way, Travis, thanks so much for calling in. Lara, how much actual work here as we wrap up, like passing legislation, do you see Congress doing next year as we get closer and closer to those 2018 midterm elections?
Well, this is where what's going to be interesting is how many incumbents are contested in primaries, because that is really what will determine what the workload is in the early spring. So if we have a lot of Republican incumbents, in fact, challenged by some of the people Steve Bannon is backing, then you are going to see more and more incumbent members of Congress saying, I got to get out of town. I got to go to my district and fight this challenge, because they know that they're not going to be able to stay here. And even if they do pass legislation, they know that they will be vulnerable at home. So this is where the real question that we have, and I don't think we're going to know for another couple months, is how embattled will the Republican incumbents be in their home districts and states?
We'll leave it there with that question looking forward. Thank you so much for joining us, Lara.
Certainly. Thanks, Kate.
Lara Brown is an associate professor, director of the Graduate School of Political Management at George Washington University, author of the book Jockeying for the American Presidency, The Political Opportunism of Aspirants. This hour was produced by Bill Martins and Keely Baltina. We had technical direction from executive producer Michelle Johnson. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, and you're listening to the Ideas Network. Stay with us.